If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Tim Gunn, author, educator, and Project Runway mentor, and you're listening to Heritage Radio.
Welcome to the second season of Magnifico Radio, the weekly podcast featuring conversations in ethical fashion, clean beauty, and sustainable living. I'm your host, Kate Black. And if you're listening live on the Heritage Radio Network, that means it's Monday and 1 o'clock here in Brooklyn. So welcome. And if you found us through iTunes or Stitcher, also welcome. And if you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. Each week, I sit down with designers, makers, and leaders in sustainability to discuss the latest in ethical fashion, clean beauty, and sustainable living. This podcast is an extension of my blog, Magnifico.com, and that's Magnifico.com, and my book also called Magnifico, Your Head-to-Toe Guide to Ethical Fashion and Non-Toxic Beauty. It's the first show of the new year. And how many of you have made resolutions or pledges to make some changes this year? How many made pledges to do with living more sustainably? Are you going to follow with the words of advice of Vivienne Westwood to buy less, choose well, and make it last? Or are you planning a fashion fast, no new clothes for the entire year, or no new fast fashion for the year? Or what about what Livia Firth recommends? You remember her of the red carpet green dress challenge. She suggests trying everything that you buy. Don't buy it unless you're sure that you'll wear it 30 times. More and more people are becoming aware of the environmental and social issues within the fashion industry, and we're trying to be the change, but maybe the change needs to start with a more critical look at what it is, and more importantly, why it is we're buying. I thought we should start the year on a reflective note, so I've asked Parsons fashion professor, author, Buddhist, activist, artist, the list goes on, Otto von Busch, to join me to talk about the allure of fashion and our fashion addiction. Welcome.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you.
So nice to see you. So let's start with all of these labels. How do you describe yourself and what you do?
Well, yes. I mean, of course, I'm a fashion scholar and fashion teacher. I mean, I teach fashion. I did fashion design and these kind of things too. But I guess I'm trying to look into what are sort of the more social and perhaps mental drives of fashion. Well, I mean, we could jokingly call it sort of metaphysics or whatever you want to call it of fashion or philosophy, although that sounds pretentious. But I think the interesting part is that so much is discussed around the industry and the system. And I'm trying to understand more, you know, how does fashion work between us as human subjects? You know, how does it work in our mind in the sense of how it's connected to self-esteem, self-worth, these kind of things, and how that, of course, is tied into the sort of capitalist or the larger economy. And if we're especially then looking at sustainability, how are we going to approach this in a way that corresponds better with the way we live socially and the way the mental functions by which we call ourselves, you know, identity and these kind of things. So those are the subjects I'm trying to look at, which of course ties my designerly practice towards a sort of a scholarshiply level, if you want to say so.
Well, and that's why I wanted to have you on and have this conversation, because the longer that I've been in sustainability and the more I dive in, the faster this industry seems to be growing. So I just don't understand it. I feel like we're getting a kind of broader understanding as a culture about what the impacts are of this industry, and yet the industry is continuing to perpetuate the kind of growth that is unsustainable, that is causing a whole bunch of systems problems, as you say it. So why are we in this conflict? Why is the industry growing at a rate that seems almost unsustainable?
I mean, my thinking around this centers on, I think so much of our discussions around sustainability mainly concerns the environment, I mean, the natural environment, if you want to say so. You know, we look at eco-cotton, we look at washing and dyeing processes and those kind of, which are easier for the industry to deal with and are perhaps, if you want to say so, a little on arm's length from the driving forces of the system, in a sense. Meaning that they're also the quick fixes, if you want to say so. And to me, I think I'm more concerned with, okay, so let's imagine we fix all these things with sustainable fashion. Let's just imagine that we tick all these boxes. It's eco. It's we pay living wages and good wages. People are happy. People are, you know, everything is good. Is that it? Is fashion, are we then in fashion utopia? Is the rest of the economy, the rest of the emotional life, the rest of the social relationships we build through the realm of dress, are we there then? You know, is the only problem with the industry that it's unsustainable because nature is suffering and people overseas are suffering? Or is it something that is also that, you know, they're suffering here? There's bullying, there's violence, there's rejection. There is people with bad self-esteem that needs to buy in order to keep up an emotional state where they feel they are worthy something. You know, is there something in the whole sort of competitive economy that we live in that draws me to consume more and more and more, you know, so that when we celebrate things like lifelong learning, lifelong change, and the amazing possibilities that sort of a liberal society, whatever, has helped us produce in society, in a free society, what we call the West, you know, how does that relate to me needing to buy more things? You know, if I'm supposed to try out a new sport now, if I start taekwondo, I have no idea, but, you know, I'm supposed to buy the gear. I'm supposed, you know, for everything, I'm supposed to sort of embody that through buying new stuff. You know, I'm supposed to change my career. I have several different jobs. Every different identity I have, I'm supposed to wear different clothes for it, in a sense, you know. So I think that's sort of tied to the more sort of free we are, in a sense, you know, the more prosperous, in a sense, a society gets, not only sort of materially, but also in possibilities, also means that we're drawn into consuming the gear for all those possibilities, in a sense, you know. So that's why I think, exactly, you know, we even though we know more about sustainability, even though we are more aware, you know, we still do it, you know, because we're drawn in a society that where our social relationships are built on those values.
Well, and you're making me recall an article I'd read over the holidays where now corporations have some sort of personification. If you think about the Kardashian lure, you know, and the new president of this country, like, reality TV is kind of the face of corporations and the face of consumption. And so we now identify with brands through these faces. And so are we being mindless a little bit in how we, like, how we need new uniforms for everything that we try, or how we need, you know, we need to kind of protect ourselves or create some sort of illusion using clothing?
I mean, for sure. And I think a difference too is today we are supposed to build a personal brand. You know, we're giving courses in how, you know, even high school students should learn how to write CVs. You know, we're supposed to build ourselves from our accomplishments in a very, very individualized sense. Meaning that also as we work with social media and Instagram and these kind of things, I'm supposed to present myself as this continuously evolving, continuously perfectuous self, you know, and so much of our, you know, the way we manifest our everyday life, it needs to be photographed, and I need to be looking good there, and I most probably should not wear the same things as last time, you know. And I think it's so fascinating. I mean, it's many years ago now, I started looking into this online platform called lookbook.nu. And I thought it was so fascinating. Suddenly there was like a total, like, street style, uncensored, in a sense, street style platform where everybody could upload images of themselves and they could hype each other and, like, build communities and these kind of things. And I first thought, wow, this is an amazing liberatory practice, in a sense. You know, people, any sort of style could emerge here. That's amazing. But of course it wasn't, you know, because at the same time it was extremely homogenizing. And And instead became this, you know, where you would have a certain kind of people that would upload new images every day in new outfits. And of course, I mean, I'm not saying that everybody bought their things, but, you know, most probably they had some relationships to stores and whatever where they could borrow, whatever. But still, in order to be on those platforms and be successful on those platforms, you have to continuously update yourself every day, a new look, and every day. And I think that just sort of, you know, it's a contagious behavior where we just are drawn into that, and awareness is not enough there. And I think this is really where the tricky part, or where I feel that we need to talk much more about sustainability in our, how does social relationships exist? How does it affect my feeling of self-worth and the sort of the psychology of clothing, in a sense, you know, that I know it's unsustainable, but I need to do it. You know, I need to have these things. I need, because I see it on my followers. Do they like me? Do they not like me? And of course, I do not want to be liked. You know, and that's where a problem is.
But I think we're kind of, we, the general public, get lulled into like seeing something, like you said, with that lookbook, because I felt the same way. The first time I saw fashion bloggers, I just all of a sudden was so excited, because here now, somebody did not choose who the model is. Somebody did not pick the model ideal, and those are the only women that are getting coverage and everything else. Now women can say, I'm the model, and the followers just kind of go. And I was really excited about this idea of this democratization of modeling and what the internet could do. And then, of course, I realized, oh, but now the pressure is on them even more, because it's self-driven to have more clothes, to do more posing, to do, and we've seen that kind of breakdown over the last year or two when Instagram stars kind of come clean about all the work that they've been doing to make this kind of pseudo life. So I think it's about maybe like kind of breaking down some of the words. And I saw you give a talk about the democratization of fashion. And in a lot of times when people are talking about fast fashion and yeah, I don't mean to go back to this kind of we can make it sustainable, but when people talk about this rate at which the fashion industry is going and this kind of locomotive that's heading ahead, full steam ahead, they talk about it as being democratized because it's affordable. And I heard you make a very interesting kind of shift about what that means. Do you know which talk I'm talking about?
I'm not too sure, but I think that the tricky part for me is that democratization to us means some sort of political empowerment, and we hold it, you know, as an ideal that you know we become participants in the political system, whereas of course we don't have any power at all in fashion, you know. And also, democracy as we know it, at least, you know, takes for granted that every person has one vote each, for example, you know, whereas of course richer people have a lot more votes in fashion than poor people and all these kind of things, you know. And also, we cannot really hold people accountable, you know. Nobody is taking our calls when we call Karl Lagerfeld and says, oh, we want more tie-dye clothes, Karl Lagerfeld, you know. Nobody's going to answer that call, because there is no such political process of participation or influencing, you know. So the tricky part with our use of democratization in fashion is not only that the fashion system is definitely not democratic, but also that it also sort of shifts back to perhaps our relationship to democracy itself, that we start treating democracy as a consumer economy also, you know. So, I mean, coming back to the way we look at elections and things, is that, well, it's the most political candidates that has the most sort of commodity appeal, or yeah, you know, but famous, yeah, that have the most influence, you know. So it's a double-edged sword there, definitely.
It's so interesting. So let's get, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and dive into addiction.
All right.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State grown and certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State grown and certified seal tells them their food is grown right, right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
And we're back. You're listening to Magnifico Radio, and I'm your host, Kate Black, and I'm sitting having a kind of post-New Year conversation with Otto von Busch. So, Otto, how did you get here? Like, did you start as a designer? Did you start as a critical thinker? Like, how did your life path lead you to kind of all of these hats that you wear?
Well, I think, technically, I never went to full-time fashion school. You know, I went to evening classes and these kind of things, and had before that studied crafts. And, you know, I had the dream of becoming a guitar builder when I was young or whatever. And then I studied art history, but started get really interested in advertisement images, and especially around fashion advertisement. So that was what I wrote my different essays and theses about. And then I also studied a design program called Material and Virtual Design that was trying to sort of look at interaction design and objects. And from there, I sort of started my PhD. And those two worlds came together, where sort of interaction design and this whole communities around digital practices, new media. This is like 15 years ago. And that sort of 20, about new media thinking, about open source, participation, media that is democratic in that sense, you know. And that interest merged then with my fashion interest from before, and I started looking into how can we hack the fashion system? Is there something, you know, what does hacking and fashion, how do they overlap? Is hacking, is the fashion industry having sort of an operating system that could be more like Linux than Windows? You know, that was sort of the metaphors I was using, and it's many years ago now. But the idea was basically sort of, could the fashion system that is not be sort of so hierarchical and elitist, but could it be more flatter and bazaar-like and more participatory? Or is there an inherent paradox there? Which I think is still the paradox I'm starting to look at, in a sense of, does fashion, how exclusive does fashion need to be? Or can it be inclusive? You know, so if it's exclusive, it needs to exclude people. But how does that, you know, if we want it more inclusive and more democratic in a truer sense and empowering, will it actually undermine the very exclusivity that we're searching for, in a sense? The more meaning that the more people that wear it, the less valuable it is, in a sense. So how is the fashion designer supposed to balance those two parts of a true emancipation, true empowerment of the subject, versus a sort of an economy that is more like a zero-sum game? You know, we compete for a certain amount of positions, in a sense, you know, and those are not open to everyone. And how could they be? What other values could we tie into then than those, for example? So a fashion designer that works with a more inclusive practice perhaps doesn't actually strive for the exclusivity that a red carpet look does, you know, but more an inclusivity that works much more on a personal empowering level, you know, meaning that it works much more with memories, more with identity production that happens through community, through the production of scenes, in a sense, you know, how subcultures produce communities and loyalty to each other, in a sense, and you know, how can clothing be part of that? What sort of rituals and what sort of services could a fashion designer orchestrate to build other values than that we work with clothes, you know? And that's, of course, can include anything from sort of different crafts, techniques, and dyeing and embroidery, la la la, those kind of things. But also recycling, in a sense, you know, how does the sort of the knitting circle and those kind of, you know, craft communities and communities of practice, how do those values balance excluding values in fashion system, and how could those be? How could the fashion designers try to work in a much wider palette or quiver, in a sense, of skills and possibilities, rather than strive for this very sort of funnel-like system where we all try to struggle for the very, very few places at the top, in a sense.
And is it in your mind then that we're all involved in this system? So designers are producing kind of more and more, and we are consuming more and more, and nobody can kind of step out of the existing structure the way that it is?
I think this is definitely the one side of what we call the democratization of fashion, or this fast fashion, or cheap, accessible fashion. Is the shift in values, where I think fashion just a few decades back were definitely something that did not concern everyone, because not everyone could access it, and it required a kind of a statement to move out turn to the sort of draw the subculture card and sort of foster that kind of sensitivity and identity production. To now, where I think everyone, basically, I'm not saying everyone, but a lot of people can have access to fast fashion, That is the big change. It basically costs as much, a new garment can cost as low as a coffee or something like that. And I think that also means that our judgment of looks on other people means that we take for granted that people are in the game, And I think that is a big change, meaning that even if not everyone is in the game, the mentality has changed to look at people as if they're in the game.
And so how do we kind of break that down? As a consumer or as a citizen, how can I break that chain, or how can I kind of step back? I titled this episode like our addiction to fashion. Like how can we in this new year and kind of this new enlightenment make change?
I mean, I think a tricky part is exactly the awareness question. We can sort of tie that back into sort of food and things too. I may be aware that corn syrup is bad for me, or, I should eat less sugar, and, that fat or that Snickers is not, or whatever, But if the craving in the stomach makes decisions for me, which are extremely hard to hold back, and that very quickly rationalize on top of my super ego, what you want to say, that oh my god, my blood sugar is so low and I have to teach this evening, so I should get that Snicker anyway, even though I know it's bad for me. I sort of, the decision has already been made in my body, and then I sort of invent the rational reason on top of it to sort of try to deal with myself. And I think we have really the same emotional response to clothing. I pass by this H&M store and I just, oh my god, that looks good, and it's just $10, and oh, and I have this job interview tomorrow. I don't know whether that sounds radical, but just, I just want to feel good about myself. Perhaps I just go in there and I rationalize afterwards. It was on the sale or whatever. I think the tricky part is that awareness is so easily tricked, and I think especially there, our cravings are just, fashion is so tied into how our social reward systems in our brain is working. And I think that is really the tricky part in how we're going to try to start addressing fashion, because we will need, awareness is not going to be enough. We need to train. We need to find situations and services and things that are almost Alcoholics Anonymous and things. We need to find training programs to try to build self-esteem and self-worth in other ways than buying and seeing ourselves on images and feeling the feedback in likes and stuff online. So we need to train ourselves to limit the reward mechanisms and the impact they have on us. The dopamine charge, the kick I get from seeing people retweeting or whatever they do with my look or whatever, and I just feel, oh my god, I'm seen, and I have the numbers on it, and look, now that person saw me, that person that I really look up to, that's amazing. And of course I feel like I'm flying, that is the dopamine journey. That is what feels so good about myself. And that is, of course, what the fashion industry is really good at tying into and make me feel that, oh, this is a cheap one, Otto, go and buy it now. Nobody knows. And this is, of course, the tricky part. it's not going to be enough to say to myself, oh, I need to hold back. No, I want that. I want to be seen. I want to be acknowledged. Everybody wants to. Everybody wants to be loved. And this is the way we feel loved in a visual culture that is so cheap and accessible, you know.
I love that you tie it actually to like food addiction or alcohol or substance addiction, because I think you're absolutely correct, and I think that most people don't actually kind of give it that credit and from a broader perspective, like understanding how much messaging we're inundated from, and to your point, like through our kind of open source or through our digital access, it's only gotten worse. And so I'm just trying to think, like, so you have children. So when your children feel this lure, like, what will you tell? Like, what are other alternatives to kind of get that confidence or to kind of, what do you suggest?
I mean, it's a tricky part. You know, even already in kindergarten, I know, you know, it happened to another of my daughter's friends. And they were only 4 years old, you know, but already as they sort of entered kindergarten, they were in Sweden. But, you know, they would be looking at each other, what they were wearing, and some were, you know, and the older kids especially. And one day our neighbor had gotten a bad comment about her red sneakers, and she refused to wear the red sneakers, you know, and she's 4 years old. And of course, I wanted to over-dramatize that, but I think there is something about how that is almost the new normal, you know, if you want to say so. And I think that what could be done is also to figure out, you know, sublimination techniques or, you know, how to find other ways to express your creativity, find other ways to feel that, you know, this may not look really cool, but I made it myself. And that is a self-worth that is different from what you can buy. For example, you know, and then looking into, you know, well, that is perhaps what that sort of creativity part that meets fashion means. You know, so if I have run a recycling workshop or something like that, it's not so much the outcome, how the outcome technically looks, and if it looks better or worse, but it's how not only did I sew it myself, you know, but I had peers looking at me, supporting me throughout this. Endeavor that I feel in my spine as courage, you know, because yes, you guys may not look at it or, you know, or like it right now, but I have 10 others that really enjoyed it last night, and that I carried their positive judgments with me in order to take more flack or more bad looks from others later, you know. And I think we, as fashion designers, we can start to manipulate transferring some of those different mechanisms of building self-worth, rather than place everything into the economy as it works, you know, everything onto the brand to tell us who we are, or the sort of, you know, that type of economized part of identity production, you know. And I think it's really interesting of how could fashion designers become much more better at orchestrating social support circles, social support systems that you know, deal with recycling, deal with other types of practices that then make me feel better about myself and my clothes, rather than feel that exactly my self-worth is dependent on what I can buy and what other people, how other people look at me.
It's true. And it's also about changing your tribe, right? Like hanging out with people or making sure that in your social circles, you're with other people who are not judging, you know, the latest trend or the label or, you know, some sort of aesthetic that's driven outside of what they like. Because I think that people also just get disconnected from what they like. Like they take a lot of cues from media and everything else. And we're not even so sure what we like anymore.
No, right. And I think that, but also there's a possibility of, like, you know, of building character, meaning that character that you're actually partially resistant against these kind of things, you know, that, I mean, bad looks and, or, you know, side looks and these kind of things, you know. So I think how can I orchestrate a fashion design system or a service that builds character, that makes me more immune to the bad look, you know, and also makes me a stronger character that I actually can, the self-esteem is emanating, radiating from me, and people will say, oh, wow, that person just owns their look, you know. And that is not necessarily dependent on what they bought, but just because they have a straight back and pride.
It's true. I went through this we just talked earlier on the break about our immigration stories, but when I first moved to this country, I couldn't work for 3 years. So I was very impoverished, shall I say. So I switched to uniform dressing because I had to. I just couldn't afford it. And then it kind of broke something about this, what you were mentioning earlier, about having to go out, be at an event, and wear something different. Or, oh my gosh, I'm going to be photographed in the same thing. To the point where now I own it. I'm photographed in almost exactly the same thing all the time. Like I have basically, you know, two black dresses and this jacket, and I wear them all the time. And I'm actually okay with that because it takes away, I don't stress about what I'm going to wear anymore. I don't worry about what image I'm trying to portray or project. I just kind of go to one of the three uniforms that I wear and I put it on and I think more about what I'm going to say and who I'm going to, you know, meet and get to focus actually on a lot of other different elements of the event. And it's kind of created a lightness that I'm so grateful for.
And I think we need to balance that. You know, it's when Vivian Westwood and others, you know, say that we should buy less and wear it longer and you know, there's also, well, then you have also reached a certain level in society, you know, or you have built your social status or whatever on other basis, or we want to say, you know, other type of scaffolding than perhaps your looks only, you know. And I think the tricky part is exactly that. It's easy for us to blame fast fashion and the people who buy fast fashion to say that they are the ones who's unsustainable, but at the same time they are often the ones who are struggling getting up, you know, up in the ladder of social esteem and making a career or whatever, you know. And I think the tricky part here is like, how do we not end up like blaming or reducing the possibilities of people for social mobility in their dressed realm, and then us sort of, you know, or the sustainable people then, you know, riding high horses and saying that we are the ones, you know, because we inherit, you know, I have clothes that my children can inherit. Well, that's because they also can inherit a certain wealth or whatever, you know, whereas those who cannot inherit that don't want to inherit their parents' old clothes, you know. So I think that's a tricky balance that still, you know, we cannot disregard that sort of an accessible and cheap fashion offers a certain kind of ability of an aesthetic social mobility, if you want to say. So how do we still preserve that type of mobility, but without the environmental and social and mental consequences of that in the competition and all these kind of things? Can there be other ways to represent that social mobility, but through other types of social esteem, other types of clothing that can be recycled and upcycled, or however we want to do it? Yes.
And so do you make your own clothes?
I do quite a lot, yes. Or a lot of remaking, I would say, rather. You know, I've had a brand for some time where I recycled... I produced cookbooks that were recycling the garments that are dying in the back of your wardrobe. So I called it Self-Passage, and I made these cookbooks, and you could download them sort of as PDFs, and the whole idea was to sort of reclaim the sewing machine, that, you know, you would teach yourself different simple methods of not having to do complicated sewing like pockets or linings or collars, or, you know, but using the already made details of old clothing that you don't use, but then how can you remake them in different ways that will still step by step make you reclaim your sewing machine, but also feel that there's something extremely gratifying that, you know, after spending just a few hours recycling something, you can try it on and you can go out there and you can just see how do people look, you know, or at me, you know,
yeah.
Is it approval or disapproval? In a sense, how that immediate feedback of modulating your look, but using stuff that you anyway basically were going to throw out because they're in the back of the wardrobe, sort of self-decomposing or whatever happens with clothes back there, you know. And you use them as this sort of material to train yourself, you know.
I can't even tell you, like, the smile on my face. I so love that, because especially if you have emotional attachment to pieces, or you're like kind of loath to let them go, but then you kind of give them new life. And so is this also on Amazon?
No, it's on selfpassage.org, where I put all these other things. It's called the Recyclopedia that I started building there.
Oh my goodness. And so where can people find more about your work? So
selfpassage.org is where I upload also my academic work, but also my artistic work, and also this old recyclopedia is there. It hasn't been updated for now some time, and when I have time I will start work that. And I also put especially these, you know, my print-on-demand books that I do, and they're also there as PDFs, so people can download them for free just for fun. But if they want a printed copy to give to someone or something, they could buy them very cheaply through a link on Amazon. That's how I put my stuff there.
Yeah, that's what I did at Christmas. I downloaded a whole bunch of your books, which are really amazing. Like, it's really lovely to kind of sit with all of this, these ideas for reflection quietly on my chair and in my corner of my house and just kind of reflect. So thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for coming out in the cold.
Thank you, Kate.
I want to thank Heritage Radio Network for supporting Magnifico Radio. There's lots of great indie programs about food, the planet, and other topics, all on Heritage Radio Network. You can see Magnifico.com. Please go and sign up for our newsletter. And if you have any feedback, questions, want to be a sponsor, recommend a guest, please just email me, radio@magnifico.com. Until next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.